Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. There is an epidemic of loneliness in our crowded society. At least half of us were emotionally wounded in early childhood, wired for insecurity, as it were. And even the rest of us are at risk in the brutal world of dating apps, ghosting, etc. What would it be like to be able to become more open with your heart fully to another, to grow your lives together, to be on a journey of mind, body, and spirit with the one you love? Today we'll be talking about a new book that invites you to open yourself to the full possibilities of love. It's a call to release your pain, learn to love from the deepest parts of your being, and create the open-hearted space that allows love to emerge in your life. Our guest on Pathways is Dr. Gary Sollier, author of the book, Safe to Love Again, How to Release the Pain of Past Relationships and Create the Love You Deserve. For the last decade, Dr. Sollier has been in private practice offering clients heart-centered transformation so they can rewrite the rules for love in their brains and step into the most loving version of themselves. He is the creator of the Safe to Love Again workshop and the Extraordinary Couples Retreat. Dr. Sollier offers a unique blend of neuro-linguistic programming, family systems approach, and attachment theory, the science of intimate relationships. Hello, Gary, and welcome to the Pathway Show.
Hello, Paul, and thank you for having me on the Pathway Show.
Well, why don't we start by asking you for what were your reasons for writing this book?
I think there's two levels. One is I had one client tell me that if you don't write the book of what you're doing with us, that I will haunt you on the other side for the next formation after. And I had some people come to workshops, like a clinical psychologist, that said, you made me a better therapist, even though they didn't come to be a therapist that weekend. And if you don't write the book, you know, the guy said it was a sin against the guild. And I said, well, we don't want to honk off any deities, you know. But the real reason really kind of goes back to when I was 7 and, you know, grew up in a dysfunctional family. And I noticed that a lot of alcoholism and everybody was divorced and miserable. And I didn't get why my aunts and uncles couldn't just love each other. I mean, kids just have that little naive way of doing it. And I'm looking at things, and I made a promise to myself I'd never be divorced. And so I went to college, first person in 7 generations to even graduate from high school. And my senior year, after taking 2 degrees to stave off a divorce, psychology and religion, my professor gives me a personality test. And once I take it, I'm walking out of his office door, and he's giving me the results. And as I'm walking out, he says, oh, by the way, you got a 90% chance of having a divorce. And it just blew me out of the water. It's like grenades going off. So I went to 5th year of college, delayed graduation to get another degree in marriage and family. And then after all that work, 12 years later, I'm getting a divorce. So now I'm like, so like, how did this happen? I got degrees to make sure this didn't. So then I do, you know, 7.5 years of therapy in between, gets, you know, to really make sure, do more workshops. And 4 years later, after I remarry, I'm looking at a divorce. And it was after that when I began to notice that while therapy had done me a lot of good, it had not changed my core style of relating. I was managing pain. It wasn't changing how I was picking, how I was creating, how I was. And that's when I said, hey, nobody should have to work this hard to have a lasting love when you do the work. So I decided, if they didn't crack the code, then I will. And that became my life's passion. I did it so that people don't have to work this hard, and so that people can avoid, divorces, needless breakups, and to have the lasting love we all deserve.
Right. And so in the book, you get into this area of neuroscience known as attachment theory. We've done some shows on attachment theory, and I've studied it quite a bit, and I think it's fascinating. And, you know, there's half the population is basically has a secure attachment and half has an insecure attachment style. Can you explain that for our audience, what that means?
Sure. We know that there was something in attachment theory where it's called the strange situation. And they brought kids into a room, and at 1 to 1.5 years old, and they separated them from their mother. And based on the reunion, they found that they had a style of loving, what they called an attachment style, that would track the rest of their life, barring intervention. So these things come on early, and it really is about how you're wired to love and be loved. The secure baby, when mom came back, they calmed down soon, and they operated like they knew love was going to be around and they were secure in it. They were comfortable loving and being loved. And when they grew up, they usually pick pretty good partners, and they're capable of maintaining love. They are comfortable being depended on and depending on somebody. Now, there were two other babies. There was also the anxious, and these babies couldn't be consoled, and they were often very angry at their mothers. And when they grew up, they were the ones that were always waiting for, when does love go away? They got intermittent responses, and some part as a fight response. I'm going to lock this thing down. So when they grow up, these become the drama kings and queens. Why didn't you text me back in 10 minutes? Where were you last night? Do you still love me? They're always worried for, when does love go away? And the worst part about it is they're so anxious, they usually drive people away.
Yeah.
And then there were the avoidant babies.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people are like that, 20%. Now, another 25% became those babies. Mom came back. Well, mom's back. No big deal. They looked like they were independent in a very wise way, but actually they weren't expecting. They were not given consistent responses. They had checked out because they felt like mom had checked them out. So when they grow up, they become avoidance. They become Mr. and Ms. unavailable. Emotionally dismissive. I can't commit. And if they do commit, it feels like they're always living in their head. They're not present. They're in the next room, whatever. But you don't feel a great connection. Their worst fear is someone's going to depend on them or they will depend on somebody else. These are the three styles that most people have: secure, anxious, or avoidant. And I wrote the book because when you read most attachment books, it says, well, you're anxious or avoidant, but it doesn't tell you how to restore them. So you might as well just put in parentheses screwed right after it, because there's no hope to actually change it. It gives you a label, and that in $5 at Starbucks.
Right.
It just might get you a copy.
You know, yeah. So many of the books I've seen, they just say, well, your best bet is to find somebody who's secure to mate with if they'll have you. And then, you know, you'll be up leveled by just being with them. And there's been, you know, there's very little out there that I've seen, and I've looked because I have an insecure attachment style, and I want to upgrade, but that's a tall order, you know, because a lot of the books just say, okay, this is the way you're wired, you know, and they don't really offer much hope for it ever changing. But there's this new concept, neuroplasticity, that you bring up. And why don't you tell us about that and why that is a hopeful thing?
Well, it's hopeful because we also know that the brain is wired for adjustment. Things don't get set in stone. We have an adaptable brain, and that's always going on. I mean, for instance, we know that 22% of people who get married in the first 2 years, they'll change their attachment style one way or the other. The secure can lose it, but if you are anxious and you marry a really secure person, there are some circumstances where the person will calm down. Not always in my experience, but it can. So we know the brain adapts. And the key point that I write about, because there is an epidemic of hopelessness out there, and that there's something wrong with me, I'm flawed, an epidemic of unworthiness, realliness. And what most books on attachment don't say is what creates that secure attachment style in that baby, and what's the roadmap back? That was the question I asked.
Yeah.
What tells a one-year baby they're loved is the same thing that will tell you as an adult, because it's online since then. And if we can restore that, then there's real hope that things can change and you can have the lasting love you deserve. And that's the real point of it all.
Right. You know, why is that so hard? It's because we keep telling ourselves the same stories, or what is it? Why is it so hard to change our beliefs about ourselves?
It goes back to, you know, I talk about these rights, that we have certain rights, that it takes six of them to have a secure love, a right to exist, and to feel welcome with joy, and a right to have your needs met, and to feel worthy and nourished, and a right to be cherished and protected, to be a me, in a we that's supportive, so you feel cherished and protected, to separate and belong, then a right to create your experience, and a right to assert, which gives you a feeling of empowered with choice. And then the last right that comes on is the right to love and be loved right back. So that gives you lovable. Now, the real key here is, if any of those rights are taken away, it's because at one point in time, usually for the little one, perhaps in an earlier relationship for some adults, but most time it goes back to 0 to 3, 0 to 7, at one time, taking that right off the board was the very, very best deal available. And then, like, for instance, in the book I talk about, I had a borderline mother, in which you didn't want to be a part of that we. The we was dangerous. You could get hit against walls. You could be slapped. So I grew up with feeling I have more right to separate than to belong. And that was the very, very best deal. But when I grow up, and nobody tells me, if I have all these degrees, but I'm still running that feeling it's not safe to truly be a we, I could never understand why my first wife said, you feel like you're in your head. I don't feel as connected. I want more, and I feel lonely. I could never understand it because I loved her deeply. But some part was always pulling me back, because at one point, a part, separate, doing it by myself, was the best deal available. And it was a horrible, bad deal for the marriage. Now, until we swap out that feeling of it's not safe to belong for, yes, I can be cherished and protected in a we, nothing changes. And that's what the book is about, restoring the feelings that tell you that love is safe. And if we don't get to those deep down inside your brain will never opt, no matter how much coaching, for a secure relationship. You've got to change the baseline feeling.
Okay, well, when we come into life, of course, we have to be loved before we can love. You know, people often say, well, you know, I'm not ready for a relationship because I got to work on myself, because until I love myself, I can't let somebody else love me. But that's not really the way we started out. We started out completely dependent upon somebody else loving us. And our ability to love ourselves is kind of connected to that experience. And so how do you change that? Now, if you had the experience with a not good enough mother, where you didn't feel loved unless you performed perfectly, and then maybe you got some crumbs of love as a reward, how can you start loving yourself in the absence of having been loved?
Well, first off, what tells your brain is these feelings. Now, there's nothing we can do to go back and change the past. The deep work that I do one-on-one with clients is give you back a right. Like, for instance, you know, if you all you got is crumbs, say you get this, and you have to be every, and it feels like you never get empowered by choice, you're never cherished. You know, there are some techniques you can do one-on-one that allow people to restore that feeling. I have a right to feel cherished. I have a right to feel worthy of more than crumbs. And when you give people back all of that feeling of worthy, the brain came equipped with these rights. You're giving them because you were born. It's a gift of life itself. We don't have to earn them. They can be taken away. And the real magic is, you know, at one point it wasn't safe to reach out because all you get is crumbs. So some part does not feel safe. We don't feel worthy. If we can find the exact flavor of safety the brain was seeking when it pulled that right off the shelf, and then tie it to the love that someone wants, it will gladly take it. And it will take that feeling of worthy. And then one thing I know from working with tons of clients is worthy people don't choose people who are takers or don't make them feel worthy, because they're worthy of more than that. We're always having the experience we have the rights for. If you can increase and give people back these four feelings that tell us the love that I talk about in the book, and so they feel it in their guts and every cell of their body, they will choose and pick and create differently. It's all based on the feelings and restoring those. It takes deep work. You can't do it by yourself, I'll grant you that. but it can be done. And that's why I wrote the book, to give people a true roadmap for what, this is the road back to the original loving, secure style that I was born with a birthright for.
Wow. So that's why so many people are afraid of love, because they don't feel they have a right.
Exactly. For instance, you know, one person I talk about in the book, her name was Gwen. She had a missing right to have her needs met. And about 85% of women do, because of a lot of cultural stuff, too. Now, at one point in time, her mother was always early in life saying, oh, you know, that's so selfish. Every time she'd ask, little children ask a lot. That's what they're here for, right?
Right.
But the real kicker came when, after her mom and dad divorced, she was on a visitation day with her dad, and they were out, and she asked for an ice cream cone. Nothing out of the ordinary. Nobody's going to have a newspaper headline tomorrow saying 9-year-old asked for ice cream cone, right?
Right.
That's not news. And on the other hand, he pulls out a wad of $100 bills and says, this is what you cost me every month. From that, she felt so unworthy, like she had to pay for love. And so unworthy that her picker was scanning for men that could not meet her needs. And at first she says, even when I'm trying, I wind up with men who are married, and I scan, but some part knew, I don't have a right to have my needs met, and always with takers or men that were already married. And when we swapped out that feeling of unworthy for worthy, everything changed. Suddenly her picker changes, because it's got better rights.
And so that restored her hope for true love.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Is this what you call the re-imprinting work?
Yes. I don't really describe it much in the book, because that would be a book written for therapists, right?
Right.
Although I have some therapists that really love the book and give it to their clients. But the real work is it would be going back on the timeline. And we really do have to find the exact moment the brain said, it's not safe.
Well, that's pretty hard. I mean, considering that it happens in the first 3 years of life, we don't generally remember anything that happened in that period.
You know, a lot of people do. And if we don't sit the exact moment, but if we can find something close back there, that's, it will be a replay, because, you know, and if we get far enough back, may not be the exact moment because there's a thing, but we get early enough, we'll find the exact flavor of safety the person was seeking.
I mean, is it ever anything so primitive as the mother refusing to breastfeed, or for whatever reason?
It could be that, absolutely. Here's one for you. A woman who was born to very secure, loving parents. And what they did not know the first month is that she could not breastfeed anywhere near enough. And the baby was starving, and she was, and her very secure mother was working her butt off to try to feed this baby, until finally a doctor figured out something was off. But that first month counted, right?
Right, right, of course.
And there was a feeling, I'm always, and what she said was, what was interesting, I'm always starved to death in my relationship.
Right, right. You know,
now that's how she experienced it, because that was the original experience all the way back.
And so you say in the book that your job is to provide, as a therapist, is to provide an alternative, attuned parental experience for early memories, so the brain can go back and learn the art of secure selfhood. So in her case, how would you do that?
We would go back, and the way the process works is, you know, without all the technical stuff, you go back and you associate them into that state. You have them look through that baby's eyes, feel what that baby's feeling, right? And when they get in that place, and the state has to be in the room, there can be no just I'm thinking about it. They have to feel. And when they get, and it doesn't, and when they feel that, then you add resources. You help them get safe with adding the feeling of, oh, worthy, how much your mother was trying to nourish you.
Right.
In this instance, I would have done, right? Now, with another one, if we had a narcissistic or mother, we might even go back and work with reimprinting the mother in an imaginary sense. But there's lots and lots of various different ways. And the moment this system fires off the first state of unworthy and then can associate and fire off worthy. Now we're training the brain to fire off unworthy, worthy, unworthy, worthy, unworthy, worthy. And eventually the brain says, okay, I've survived. It's safe being worthy. But at one time it wasn't safe feeling worthy.
Right.
So that's the key.
So the name.
There's some other things in.
Uh-huh.
But that's it in a nutshell and a little bit. It's a little more technical than I usually do, but it's really helping that brain reassociate feelings with love.
And one of the ways you do that is by restoring the rights or the person's felt sense that they are entitled to these natural connections.
Our brains are born with, we are wired for connections and love. Babies don't live very long without it. The amoeba doesn't think, do I have a right to have my needs? It just absorbs. Your lungs breathe. You have a right to have your needs.
Okay, so like
all these rights.
For the average listener out there who might be divorced, who might be single, if our brain is wired on the absence of some of these rights or some, ownership of these rights, that result will determine your love style, and the same for any prospective partner. So what advice would you give singles who have a hard time dating? Let's say that people have studied your book and they figured out what their attachment issues are. How does that help them?
Okay. Like, for instance, let's just make it practical. Worked with a client this fall, and she really didn't feel unworthy. I mean, she felt unworthy, and she never felt cherished. Now, when you don't feel worthy and you don't feel cherishable, your brain always creates the experience it has the rights for. So the first session, before we get out of the gate, she goes, oh, I think I found somebody on Tinder, right? And she goes, and I think I've hit the jackpot. And I say, tell me about Mr. Jackpot. Mr. Jackpot is 6'2", good-looking, tall, and he's a doctor, and he even does yoga. Okay. Now, but about 3 to 4 weeks later, she does not feel worthy or cherished by this guy, even though he's Mr. Jackpot, and she checked the list, and he says, yeah, he likes yoga. He's always checking out all the other women. So her brain picked based on those two feelings. I will feel unworthy, and I will feel uncherished. It uses those as references.
Uh-huh.
So we do the work, and we help her brain to feel worthy.
Right.
And cherished. And a few months later, she goes online, and there's another Mr. Jackpot. Same deal, except he's an attorney this time. The same Italian silk tailored suit, And then there's another guy. He's a good guy, stable job, He comes dressed in a Hawaiian t-shirt. A little balding, a little overweight, but he makes her feel great. And she chooses this one, not the other one.
Uh-huh.
That's the difference between worthy and cherished. And, because she goes, I'm going with the one that makes me feel great.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Why did she do? Different reference feelings.
Now, how do you tell if someone is emotionally available? We hear that phrase slung around, emotionally available.
Well, it's really interesting. There's lots and lots of traits. Like, for instance, let's put something like I sometimes do on Tinder or online apps. Have you ever seen people that show up with a Roy Orbison sunglasses?
Yeah.
They're already telling you they don't want you to see you. You don't want them to see into their souls, okay? Or they don't want you to see into their souls. Or the ones that, and you can look on the horizon and there they are 50 feet behind it. They're already telling you what sort of distance they need in a relationship. They're starting off that way. Or they text indefinitely. Or, 3 weeks later, you still haven't met. These are all signals. These are all signals of whether they're available or not. And then when you get in a relationship, how well do they meet your needs? How well do they listen? How well do they respond? Or are they more responsive to their cell phones, which is a way of distancing. I got to keep my connections online. But the real idea is, but it keeps me tamping down the connection with you. This is why, and that's an epidemic in this society. And there's all sorts of ways, but how well do they respond to your feelings in an attuned way? or do they dismiss them? And how well are they tracking your bids for support and attention and responding? And they find out, oh, you know, Paul likes a double espresso latte with Olé at Starbucks, right? Or a caramel macchiato, you know, or Paul's a night owl. You know, she's noticing that. So she'll call, but she doesn't call at 6 and 7 in the morning. But she might call at 10 because she knows you're up. These are the things.
Right, right. That's beautiful.
Tell us.
That's beautiful.
Well, there's so much in this book. There's so much in this book. It's really a gold mine. It's one of the better ones I've read. I really enjoyed every minute of it. And you give a lot of advice for singles. And you also put things in perspective, you know, about, you say, you know, the way that we are being treated in our relationships these days is pretty shabby. Singles are constantly getting dumped for someone better by the most insensitive of means. Ghosting is rampant and painful. I think it's interesting the way you say the single most destructive and abusive thing anyone can do to another person's attachment system is to cut off a relationship without any contact or warning. The amount of stress and damage that ghosting does to our love styles is off the charts. Wow, Gary, this is great stuff. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing? Because there's so much more we could explore, but we have run out of time.
Well, I just like to say that if you're listening out there, you are worthy, no matter what you've experienced in life. There's no part of you that's wrong. For wherever you're at, no matter what your patterns are, at one point in time, your brain took the very, very best deal available. A few weeks ago, I was at an event talking, and a friend was talking to me and called over another friend. Said, oh, Dr. Gary's written this new book on love. And this woman turned white as a sheet. She goes, oh, no. Not another book to tell me how wrong I am. There's nothing wrong with it. Yeah. Oh, it was painful to see this woman's reaction.
Wow.
And what I explained to you is that at one point in time, it was the very best deal.
Right.
And all it is giving your brain that's working hard to keep you on the planet a better deal. And right. Maybe, you know, maybe even give it a, you know, whatever that part of you that's protecting you, to give it a better contract with a pay raise, maybe even a view, an office view with a window of cold
love.
Right.
Well, that's,
you know, that's, if we do that, you're totally worried. So, you know,
thank you, Gary.
Back to the whole.
Thank you, Dr. Salyer, for the vote of confidence. And I want to direct our listeners to your website, which is garysalyer.com. That's GarySalyer. And for those who tuned into the Pathway Show late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast. Today, we've been visiting with Dr. Gary Salyer, author of Safe to Love Again, How to Release the Pain of Past Relationships and Create the Love You Deserve. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed via KBOO.fm, Sunday mornings at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, that's divination.com, as well as via iTunes and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and Podcasts. And thanks again to Gary Salyer and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways Conversation.